work, look how long since my last promotion. I'm worthy of this position, I'm worthy of a new position, a promotion. That's how it works with a boss. How does it work with God? What makes us worthy before God? Whatever we'd say on a theology exam, subconsciously we can think, I deserve for my life to go smoothly. Why? Well, because of what I've done. I've contributed to church, I've gone to church, I'm here today. I've been a good boy, been a good girl, whatever it is. I'm worthy of God keeping my life on track because of what I've done. But when you approach God like that, it produces either pride when it's all going very well, or despair when you feel like you've missed the target. This story is about worthiness, and it's for the puncturing of pride and for the comfort of those who are in despair. So let's get in the story. Point one, you'll see there on the sheets, seeming worthy. So verse 1-5. So we meet a man who looks worthy of Jesus' help. Verse 2, he's a centurion, that's a commander of 100 in the Roman army, the best army of the day, and he needs help. Verse 2, he has a servant who is sick and at the point of death. And he seems worthy of Jesus' help. He's got lots to be proud of. He's been given a position of authority in the army. His leadership gifts and abilities, they've shone through. Maybe he's shown outstanding bravery in the field. Verse 2, he cares deeply about the men under him, so he values his servant highly. He's not just some minion to be bossed around. And look at his generosity. Did you see that in verse 5? He loves the Jewish nation where he's been stationed. And he's even built us our synagogue, our Jewish equivalent of a church. What might a 21st century version of this guy look like? Wealthy enough to build a synagogue? I don't think many army commanders would be. Maybe we need to go for a wharf exec. But he's no executive kind of caught up in scandal. Instead, he's the model boss. Everyone wants to work on his team. They're all transferring and putting in a transfer to his team. He's a model citizen. He's involved in all the right charities. He earns respect wherever he goes. He seems very worthy. And verse 4, everyone else thinks that. They think he's worthy of Jesus' help. Did you see that? The Jewish leaders in verse 4 come to Jesus. And they let themselves be sent by this Gentile, this non-Jew. Surprising enough. And then they plead with Jesus earnestly, saying, he is worthy to have you do this for him. 4, verse 5, he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue. What's going on in the mind of these Jewish elders? They probably didn't understand it this way, but let's go with it like this. They thought God was like a vending machine. Okay, God was like a vending machine. So there I was, age 5, had my first ever bit of pocket money in my hand. I had 30p. It's a lot of money. I was living the dream. And I could go to the vending machine and I could put in my 20 and my 10 and I could press Coca-Cola. And out it came after the swimming lesson. You can see how much it meant to me. I can still remember the exact details. 30p, that wouldn't even buy you a Freddo, one of those little chocolates anymore, would it? But it bought me a whole can of Coke. You see how it works. You take what you've got and you put the money in and then it vends what you've asked for. Well, this is what they're saying ultimately about God. Look, Jesus, this guy has put a lot of good works in God's spiritual vending machine. Now do your bit, vend some blessing. Give out the blessing. Heal his servant. He is worthy. Blatantly or subtly, we can end up thinking this is how it works with God. In goes my good. I've loved my family. I go to church. I give to church. I'm diligent at work. Now do the vending machine, God. Give me some blessing. Did you ever have those moments with vending machines where you put your money in and you're after that pack of crisps and it would, like, I don't know if these are only UK ones, but it would like twizzle, but it wouldn't quite twizzle far enough and the pack of crisps would kind of get stuck and it would be hanging there. and it was your last 50p, and you couldn't get the pack of crisps, and you were just left sort of slamming the edge of the vending machine going, give me my blessing, give me my food. Well, that was me anyway. Turns out, apparently, statistics, you can say, get them to say anything, can't you? But apparently more Americans are killed each year by vending machine disaster than by sharks. So 3 Americans are killed a year by vending machines falling on them when in their fury and trying to shake the thing out of them, it falls on them. Maybe in a tiny little way, it can feel a little bit like that with God. You know, God, I've put in my good deeds. Now, come on, vent. Give me my blessing. Give me what I want in my life. And maybe we're just after a can of Coke, the traffic to clear, the kids to sleep through the night. Maybe we're after something bigger. Apparently in Abu Dhabi's Emirates Palace, there's a vending machine for gold bars. So you're after something really big. You'd be really annoyed if that one sort of spun and then didn't drop, wouldn't you? Maybe we're after something really big. Maybe we're in desperate need of healing ourselves, like in this passage, there at the point of death. Maybe it's a family member we're thinking of. Maybe we need rescue from that nightmare job, that relationship, that lack of relationship. We need blessing. How do we get that? How do we become worthy of it? Actually, there's something deeper going on in this passage than just material and physical well-being. There's something spiritual going on. It's a salvation miracle, I'd want to argue. So Luke's gospel repeatedly uses a word that means heal and save. And he just uses the word interchangeably for both. So in 7 verse 3, it's come and heal, that word. But then in 7 verse 48, when he's talking to the sinful woman, he says, go in peace, your faith has saved you, your faith has healed you. It's the exact same word. Luke thinks physical healings point beyond themselves to the ultimate healing, salvation, right relationship with God now, access to God's eternity then, where every sickness, physical and spiritual, will be gone for good. How do we get that blessing from God? It's been the question up to this point in Luke's gospel. The religious leaders think they know the answer. They're saying, look, it's about what you put in. You do the vending machine thing. They've been saying, keep the rules, fast, keep the Sabbath, be Jewish. Those things will get you salvation. It's how most world religions operate. You know, put in the coin, put in your 5 prayers a day or whatever it is, and out comes your eternal life. It's even there in twisted forms of Christianity. So you know, input prayer, input Bible reading, input church attendance, mass attendance, giving. God will then output for you maybe extra blessing in this life, financial or otherwise, or maybe blessing in eternity. Well, vending machine religion is humanity's default setting, but it doesn't work. We don't get the perfect lives we've asked for now. It just produces either pride or despair. If things are going well, we just end up being proud of ourselves, pointing to ourselves. Look at what I've achieved. And it stops us being compassionate to others. Truly compassionate anyway. We might think, well, I'll be nice to that person. It'll earn me a bit more change to put in the machine with God's. But I won't be truly compassionate. In fact, I'll think, well, the reason you're doing worse than me is because you've put less in the machine. It breeds pride or it breeds despair. So a guy called Tim Keller says this, the presumption of spiritual entitlement dooms its bearers to a life of confusion when things in life inevitably go wrong. But I thought this is how it worked. But then why are things going wrong? Pride or despair. Vending machine religion doesn't work. Instead, we need a better way. And that's what this centurion gives us. So he seems worthy. But this is a man who senses himself, for himself he senses this, that he is unworthy. So that's verse 6 and 7, if you see the second point there on the sheet, sensing we're unworthy. So in chapter 5, earlier on in Luke's Gospel, Simon Peter gets a glimpse of what Jesus is like. And the moment he does, as Jesus brings in this miraculous catch of fish, he just falls to his knees and says, "Away from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man." And that's a note this passage hits again. This guy won't even approach Jesus himself. So verse 3, he sends the elders to Jesus instead of him. And verse 6, the centurion hears that Jesus is coming and rushes out a delegation of his friends. They carry this message. Did you see it there in verse 6? "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you." Can you imagine that happening in this self-obsessed world? I don't know, I was trying to think of what example to use. You know, is it, are we to imagine, I don't know, Jose Mourinho at Old Trafford with Man United? He hears that Prince Harry wants to take Meghan on a tour, and he writes back to Prince Harry, "No, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof." You know, this is the guy who calls himself the special one. We don't get that sense of being unworthy. And yet here is this man who, when he thinks of Jesus, when he hears of Jesus, he goes, I'm unworthy. He knows the Jewish elders think he's great. They've probably sucked up to him ever since he built them their synagogue. But this is the thing, he can see behind his own facade. So he sees the mixed motives behind all he does. He sees his selfishness right there alongside acts of selflessness. His impurity alongside his good works. A writer called T.S. Eliot said, "We engage in an eternal struggle to think well of ourselves." That's the kind of what it's like to be a human. An eternal struggle to think well of ourselves. We want to, and you know, when we're selective enough with the evidence, we can just about pull it off. But it's quite an uncomfortable feel. So we've got to keep suppressing those other bits that say otherwise. But here is a man who's given up that eternal struggle to think well of ourselves. He's accepted it. He thinks Jesus should not think well of him. So he's given up the vending machine approach to God. He's given up on the religious approach to God. He doesn't have enough to put in if God were that vending machine. What we do, our veneer, is not enough. We couldn't ever make God, make Jesus, owe us anything. I think our society finds this story hard for another reason, though, because he's given up on the secular approach to worth, too. It's the religious form of worth. You know, I've done enough. The secular approach to worth these days is just get it from yourself. Just sum it up inside yourself. The belief that I am worthy. You know, it's time to see who we can be, to test the limits and break free. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. Thank you, Princess Elsa from Frozen. If you didn't get that cultural reference, spend some time with some kids, maybe. Yeah, I got that from babysitting. These two kids just absolutely loved Frozen. It was amazing, and they knew all the words. These two little boys, the son of this big hulking rugby player, but there they were, blasting out Elsa. We're to affirm ourselves because we're doing what we want to do. We're to be who we want to be, and it doesn't matter what others think. So this centurion has sinned against that secular principle that we have. He looks inside and doesn't see something worthy. But when you kind of step back from that approach to worthiness, we just see it doesn't work. You know, if literally everyone else around us thought we were a monster, we couldn't cope. We couldn't just say, it doesn't matter, I affirm myself, I give myself worth. It doesn't work, does it? We're irreducibly social and relational. We need someone we respect to respect us. The greater the worth of that someone, the more sense of self and worth they can give us. Sensing we're unworthy. Do we sense we're unworthy here today? do we know that if it came down to what we do, we'd fall short before God? Have we felt that failure to create our own sense of worth? This man senses he's unworthy, and yet it doesn't drive him into a pit of despair. It doesn't leave him trying to put more coins in the machine. It doesn't leave him trying to create his own sense of worth. Instead, it drives us to Jesus. Third point, the one who saves the unworthy. That's the last three verses. The one who saves the unworthy. So we don't know what this centurion's heard. Maybe he's heard of Jesus' miracles. Maybe he's heard a report of his teaching. Maybe he's been there in the synagogue he built. And he's been listening to the Jewish scriptures being read and taught week after week. And he's just, he gets that there's a Jewish promised Messiah, rescuer coming. But he knows enough to go to Jesus. He gets Jesus is worthy where he is unworthy. Why is Jesus worthy? He gets he's worthy because he's the one with authority. So verse 7 is saying, don't come to my house, Jesus, A, because I'm unworthy, but B, you don't need to. You've got the authority to just say the word, and even at a distance, my servant will be healed. So out of all people, soldiers understand authority, don't they? I was reading the other day about the 9-week training course that Taiwanese Marines go through in order to qualify. They just have to do exactly what their commanding officer says for 9 weeks, and it's absolutely grueling stuff. But the high point, the low point, whatever you make of it, is that they have to complete a 50-meter crawl over a course of rocks, jagged coral that they must writhe across on their stomachs. Their commanding officer says, jump. They say, how high? Their commanding officer says, crawl over this barrage of rocks. They say, yes, sir. No, sir. 3 bags full, sir. They understand authority. Soldiers understand authority. This centurion gets authority. So verse 8, he says, I'm a man set under authority. My general says, jump. I say, okay. And he says, I've got soldiers under me. I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. So he gets Jesus is worthy because he gets Jesus has authority. So he says to Jesus, say the word, just say the word. You don't need to come, and he'll be healed. Next week, we're going to watch Jesus' authority, his worth, on even greater display as he raises this young boy from the dead as he touches this funeral pyre. Luke's so convinced of Jesus' power, he doesn't even really need to record this miracle. He just says, verse 10, when the group returns, they found the servant well. Jesus is worthy. He's the man with authority. But Luke knows Jesus isn't just worthy because of his authority. He's worthy because of how he treats the unworthy. So Jesus, when you watch him in Luke's gospel, he doesn't just trample on the unworthy. He goes to the cross for them. At Jesus' trial, Pilate says, 23:15, if you want the reference, this man has done nothing literally worthy of death. He's the only one, Jesus, who's lived a worthy life. And yet he's hung up on a cross between two unworthy criminals. One criminal turns to the other and says, we are receiving what our deeds deserve. Literally, what is worthy of our deeds. Same word. But this man, he has done nothing wrong. And yet as this worthy one dies, he can turn to an unworthy criminal next to him and just say the word. Today you will be with me in paradise. And it happens because Jesus, the worthy one, dies. He can rescue the unworthy. What does this mean for us as we come into toward a close? Again and again, Luke's gospel says, rejoice. As we fail to do as we should do, as our deeds make us unworthy, here is one who can deal with that, who can bless us anyway. as we fail to conjure up that sense of self-worth, as we see the holes in that approach to worth, well, here is a path to true worth. Here is one who sees our failure and values us enough to die for us. Here is the one with the greatest worth imaginable who can give us the greatest, most secure sense of worth. We find our value in being valued by this worthy one. But as we rejoice, we're not to fall into the trap of vending machine religion. We need to focus on the big realities of salvation. Jesus has died to save us. He is taking us to his perfect new creation to be with him forever. The big blessing has come. It is coming. We don't need to slam the machine in frustration. Instead, we can trust. Individually, if he's given that big blessing, we can have certainty. We know that he knows what he's doing with the rest, even when we have got not a clue what he's doing. We can cry out to him in prayer, and yet not in unbelief. Corporately, as a church, maybe sometimes we feel like God is ticking all the boxes. He's doing what we expect. We're seeing people turning to Jesus. We're blessed in different ways. But sometimes other things happen that make you just go, God, what's going on? Why is that changed? What's happened there? Well, again, we're not to slam the machine in frustration, if you like. We're to humbly come to our Father and say, we trust you, we love you. We want your kingdom to grow. What do you want to happen in this situation? Last angle as we close on this passage. What is a Christian? What makes someone a real Christian? I was chatting to someone the other day, and she just couldn't get past the fact true Christianity isn't just a cultural identity. She was saying, no, I am a Christian. Culturally, I'm not Muslim. I've been baptized, confirmed. I believe in Christian morality. I'm a Christian, right? But you see, that's not what this passage is saying. There are religious people in this passage, lots of religious people in this passage, but they're not Christian in the way Jesus would want us to use that word. So verse 9, Jesus is impressed by only one man in this story, the centurion. It's almost ominous what he says in the hearing of these religious leaders. I haven't found this faith even in Israel. So here's a man who wasn't born in the right country, yet he is counted right before God. As you look at the Jewish religious leaders in Luke's gospel, you find people who have seemingly lots of the right spiritual credentials and yet counted not right before God. It doesn't matter if we were baptized, doesn't matter if we go to church every week, doesn't matter if we tick Christian on the form or put it on the Facebook profile or whatever form. What matters is what we believe about Jesus and about ourselves. So the word Christian is so muddled up in our culture that when someone tells me they're a Christian, it just doesn't mean anything to me anymore. It makes me want to go, okay, now tell me what you actually believe. So many different things go under the name of Christianity. What does a real Christian believe in this passage? A real Christian sees themselves as unworthy before God, and yet they see Jesus, the one with absolute authority to heal, restore, and forgive, to bring them to the new creation. And because they see who Jesus is, they put themselves under Jesus' authority. That when Jesus says go, they go. When Jesus says stop, they stop. Are we people who the course of our life, the direction of travel, not the slips and stumbles along the way, but the direction of travel is toward making Jesus the authority figure in our life? Later in the service, we're going to take Lord's Supper, communion. It's not an empty ritual. It's about what we believe about Jesus and about ourselves. And we're going to pray these words together. We do not presume to come to this your table trusting in our own righteousness, but in your manifold and great mercies. We are not worthy, we're not worthy so much as to gather up the crumbs under your table, but you are the same Lord who delights in showing mercy. Well, are we people that have sensed our unworthiness? Are we people who see Jesus as worthy? Have we put our trust in him? Have we made him our ruler and our rescuer? And are we praising God that there is one who is able to save the unworthy? Let me lead us in a prayer. Father, we know that we are not worthy so much as to gather up the crumbs under your table. And yet we praise you that you are the Lord who delights in showing mercy, who sees faith that gets unworthiness and gets your power and trusts. Please make us people like this centurion. Please would that seep into every area of our life and how we live. In Jesus' name, amen.